Welcome to The Immigrant Voice, where we delve into the intricate and constantly changing world of U.S. immigration law. I'm Lean Tran Layton, a U.S. immigration attorney with over a decade of experience, and I'm an immigrant myself. I'll be covering a variety of U.S. immigration law topics, and I'll also share real-life client stories and answer listener questions. Quick disclaimer, the information provided in this podcast is informational only and should not be taken as legal advice. With that said, let's dive into the fascinating and ever-changing world of U.S. immigration law. In today's episode, I will be talking about the recent Florida laws that were signed by Governor Ron DeSantis that will impact immigrants in that state, as well as the Dignity Act of 2023 that was introduced by Representative Maria Elvira Salazar of Florida. I'll also be talking about birthright citizenship and what Trump recently said about it. Governor Ron DeSantis has been in the news a lot regarding his stance against the immigration policies of the Biden administration. He signed into law a comprehensive immigration bill that would affect undocumented immigrants in that state. This law will only impact those who are in Florida, but I know that there are other states who are implementing similar laws to this. So let's just dive right into it. So this bill is the Senate Bill 1718. And it's basically, like I said, a comprehensive legislation aimed to restrict the ability of undocumented immigrants to live and work in that state. One of the big things of this law is that it gives state law enforcement agencies a lot more power to enforce immigration laws. Immigration law is federal law, so typically it's federal law enforcement agencies that enforce these laws. But this law will allow state law enforcement agencies to have greater power to collaborate with the federal authorities in enforcing immigration rules and regulations within Florida. So I'm going to give a summary of the different provisions of this law. So the first one is transporting undocumented individuals into Florida. So this law would make it a serious crime to bring someone into Florida if they entered the U.S. without documents or without permission. So it would be considered human smuggling. And if someone is found guilty of human smuggling, they can go to prison for up to 15 years. But this law doesn't make it a crime to live with, help, or transport undocumented individuals within Florida. So for example, if you are a U.S. citizen and you're married to a spouse who is undocumented and you both live in Florida and you live together and you ride in a car together, that's not going to be considered a crime or human smuggling. This law will also require hospitals in Florida that accept Medicaid to ask patients if they are U.S. citizens or legally living in the United States. Now, patients can choose to not answer the question, so they don't have to, but hospitals do have to ask patients that question if they accept Medicaid. And the law also requires the hospitals to send reports to the Florida Agency of Healthcare Administration every 3 months. Now, these reports won't contain any personal information about the patients. This report is required to be sent. The forms that these patients will fill out asking about their immigration status, the forms do have to have a caveat on it stating that their response is not going to affect the patient care and that their immigration status will not be reported to immigration authorities. This law will also affect employers, obviously. So employers will have to check if new employees are allowed to work in the United States within 3 days of starting their job. And companies with 25 or more employees have to use E-Verify to make sure that these new employees are authorized to work. If employers don't follow these requirements, they could be fined up to $1,000 per day and even lose their business license. Like I mentioned earlier, state law enforcement agencies are going to be given a lot more authority to check these immigration violations. So the state law enforcement agencies will also be given the authority to request documents from employers to make sure that they've complied with the employment verification process for their employees. And if it's found that the employers did not properly go through the employment verification process, they'll have 30 days to fix the issue. And these state law enforcement agencies will be allowed to do random audits of businesses to make sure that they're complying. The law will also restrict access to driver's licenses and professional licenses. So somebody who needs a professional license to practice, for example, like a lawyer, if that person cannot show legal status, that person will not be able to practice law in Florida. So counties and municipalities will be restricted from using government funding to issue identification documents to people who are not living in the U.S. lawfully, and also driver licenses from other states that have been issued to undocumented immigrants won't be valid in Florida. And as stated, this law will give more power to local law enforcement agency and more power to Florida's chief of domestic security to coordinate immigration enforcement activities with federal agents. And state law enforcement agencies will also be required to take DNA samples from people who are in their custody because of an immigration issue. This law will be effective on July 1st of 2023. So even though it hasn't been implemented yet, I've been reading news articles about how it's already impacted the economy there and different industries like construction, agriculture, and how a lot of people have actually left. So even though the law isn't fully in effect yet, there are already economic impacts that are happening in Florida. Another bill that Governor DeSantis signed into law recently that will go into effect also on July 1st of 2023 is a law that restricts land ownership in that state by people from certain countries. So on May 8th, DeSantis signed a law, the Florida Senate Bill SB 264, that limits land ownership in Florida by foreign nationals from certain countries. So those countries are China, Venezuela, Syria, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and Cuba. So people from those countries cannot own agricultural land or any land within 10 miles of a military base or important infrastructure. But if people from those countries are citizens or green card holders, then they're not affected by this law. So the main points of that law is that people from those countries that I had mentioned can't directly or indirectly own or buy agricultural land or any part of it unless it is a very small part, so less than 5% ownership of a company that owns the land. They also cannot own or buy land within 10 miles of a military base or important infrastructure in Florida unless it is a very small part, less than 5% ownership of a company that owns the land. So important infrastructure would include facilities like chemical, manufacturing plants, power plants, seaports, and airports. And also as part of this law, starting on July 1st of 2023, people who want to buy land in Florida will have to provide a document saying that they are not from any of those countries. And for people who had already owned agricultural land before July 1st, they can keep it, but they have to register it. And if they don't register, then they have to pay a $1,000 penalty per day. And for people who don't comply with these rules, they'll face penalties like having their land taken away or even criminal charges. Now, this law will have specific restrictions for people from China. So people from China, including government officials, political party members, and business organizations, cannot buy land in Florida unless they are U.S. citizens or permanent residents. And for those who own land before July 1st, they'll also have a registration requirement, and buyers after the law starts need to prove that they aren't affected by these rules. Now, there is an exception for Chinese people who want to buy a house, so up to 2 acres, for living as long as it is not within 5 miles of a military base and they have a valid U.S. visa. And diplomatic properties are also exempt. So on May 22nd of 2023, a lawsuit was filed against this particular law about the land ownership restrictions, arguing that it's unconstitutional and discriminatory. Let's move on now to the Dignity Act. So this was introduced by Representative Maria Elvira Salazar of Florida in the U.S. House of Representatives on May 23rd of 2023. So this is a pretty sweeping immigration bill, which covers a lot of different things. So I'll just summarize some of the main points of this bill. It has provisions related to border security, providing legal status to undocumented immigrants who are already here in the U.S. It also talks about asylum and unaccompanied minors. So we'll just kind of go over, like I said, the main points of the bill. Okay, so let's go over the border security provisions. So this bill would provide funding to upgrade the technology and equipment used by U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, and it includes things like better communication systems, improved surveillance, and updated license plate readers. But there won't be any funding for restarting the construction of that border wall that Trump had started during his administration. It will also increase the number of Border Patrol agents and officers and improve training for them. And it'll also support the communities that are near the borders to make sure that they have the resources to help the migrants that do arrive there. The bill would also allocate $10 billion over 5 years to expand and modernize ports of entry, which would include vehicle, cargo, and pedestrian inspection lanes. And also an immigration infrastructure fund would be established to cover these necessary costs. I think the provision that's gotten the most attention is the legal status for undocumented immigrants that this bill would grant if it was passed. So this bill would offer a path to legal status for undocumented people living in the U.S. It would give them legal status that would allow them to stay in the country and work legally. And to be a part of this program, they would have to pay a $5,000 fee over the course of 7 years, pass a background check, pay any outstanding taxes, and also continue paying taxes. It would create a special legal status for undocumented agricultural workers, which would allow them to become permanent residents if they worked in agriculture for a certain number of years. It will create a pathway for citizenship for certain groups. It'll protect Dreamers, so young people who came to the U.S. as children, by offering them a chance to become U.S. citizens. It would keep families together by providing a pathway to citizenship for parents and children who are separated due to immigration issues. And it also includes a redemption program that allows the Dignity Program participants to apply for citizenship after completing additional requirements. And for those who choose to serve in the military, they would have the option to be able to become citizens through their service. regarding asylum, so the bill would establish regional processing centers in Latin America to provide services and pre-screening for potential asylum seekers. It also creates humanitarian campuses in the U.S. to determine credible fear and expedite asylum cases. And then also additional asylum officers would be hired. Regarding the credible fear interviews for asylum seekers, so under this bill, if it were to be passed, the asylum seekers would be given a credible fear interview within the first 15 days of them arriving to the U.S., but they would be given a 72-hour rest period to be able to consult with legal counsel. And if the asylum seeker can prove that they have credible fear of going back to their home country, then an asylum officer would have to decide on their case within 45 days. But if it's a case that's too complex for the officer to decide within that time frame, they could refer it to an immigration judge. The bill has an expanded reunification program that would be implemented for minors. So similar to the Central American Minors Program for children and young adults under 21 with a parent or guardian in the U.S. with legal immigration status. And lawyers who serve at these humanitarian campuses would be part of a new federal loan repayment program. One of the big things that I think definitely needs to be changed is the visa backlogs. And this bill would address the visa backlogs and caps. So every year, only a certain number of people can immigrate to the U.S. depending on how they're immigrating here and which family member petitioned for them to immigrate here. And the number of visas available for these family members to immigrate here hasn't increased in decades, and it hasn't kept up with demand. So there's this huge backlog of people who are basically just waiting to be able to immigrate to the U.S. So for example, if you have a brother or sister, you're a citizen, and you, let's say that your brother or sister is from Mexico, it's over a 20-year wait. Same with if your brother or sister is from the Philippines, it's over 20 years. If your sibling is from China, mainland born, it's over a 15-year wait. If your sibling is from India, then it's over a 17-year wait. So it's a really long time. So the bill would create a new position called the Immigration Agency Coordinator that would oversee immigration functions and provides additional funding to improve visa processing. It would also raise the visa cap for each country, which would allow more people from different countries to come to the U.S. legally. So not only would it be helpful to increase the visa numbers for family-based immigration, but also for employment-based immigration, because again, for some of these employment categories, for somebody to be able to immigrate or to get a green card through employment, it can take a really long time, especially if you're from like India. It takes a really long time to be able to get an employment-based green card because of this visa cap and backlog. The bill also talks about the guest visa reform, which is like visiting visas when someone's coming to the U.S. to visit here temporarily. So the bill would enhance visa security, mandate visa overstay reporting, and it would introduce a new 90-day visitor visa for certain foreign visitors and allow F1 students to have dual intent, meaning that they can have the intent to also live in the U.S. permanently. There would be reforms made to the H-2B program. So these are temporary work visa programs, and like the H-1B, H-2Bs and H-2As have a cap, and every year, way more employers apply for these visas than there are visas available. So it makes it really difficult for employers to be able to get the help that they need to be able to do their jobs. So with the reforms that would be made to the H-2B program, it would make it easier for returning workers to fulfill the labor needs. And the H-2A program would be expanded to include year-round agricultural work. And spouses of H-1B immigrants would be able to receive work authorization without having to apply for a work permit. So they would basically automatically get work authorization once they've gotten the H-4 status. Another provision deals with spouses and children of green card holders or lawful permanent residents. So this bill would allow for spouses and minor children of green card holders to be exempt from the current green card cap, allowing them to apply for permanent residency. So it'd be similar to like immediate relatives of U.S. citizens. So immediate relatives of U.S. citizens are not subject to this visa cap, and there's no visa backlog. It's just obviously waiting for the processing times, but there's no like visa backlog of years and years like there are for other family members. So I just want to reiterate, though, that this bill has not passed. It's just been introduced. So we will see what happens. I mean, I've been doing this for almost 14 years now. And so far, I mean, there's been definitely a lot of policy changes and a lot of procedural things that have changed. But as far as like these big things changing, hasn't happened yet for as long as I've been practicing. So we'll see what happens. The next topic I want to talk about is birthright citizenship. So Trump recently announced that if he became president again, he would end birthright citizenship by executive order for children of undocumented immigrants. And this is something that he had talked about in the past as well. So let's just start off with a little bit of history about the 14th Amendment. So it starts off with Section 1, which says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. And it's been recognized that all states within the U.S. and its territories, such as Puerto Rico, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, are considered part of the United States jurisdiction, but places like American Samoa and Swains Islands are territories, but they are not part of the United States jurisdiction, meaning that people who are born there are not considered citizens, and they don't automatically become citizens at birth, but instead they're considered U.S. nationals, which they basically have all the rights of citizens, except for they can't vote and they can't hold elected office. And also, if they want to petition for certain family members, they are considered like green card holders. So they can only petition for family members that green card holders can petition for, but U.S. nationals can naturalize and become U.S. citizens. There have been cases throughout history about birthright citizenship where the Supreme Court has sought to interpret what the 14th Amendment means and what it means to have birthright citizenship. In the case of Dred Scott v. Sanford in 1857, the U.S. Supreme Court held that African Americans born in the U.S. were not citizens. This decision was considered one of the worst decisions ever made by the U.S. Supreme Court, and in 1868, Congress then amended the 14th Amendment to undo what had happened. Then, about 30 years later, the court ruled on another birthright citizenship case in the case of United States v. Wong Kim Ark, and this dealt with whether an American-born Chinese person would be considered a U.S. citizen. The plaintiff in this case was the son of Chinese immigrants, and his parents had come to the U.S. legally, but they weren't able to become U.S. citizens because of the Chinese Exclusionary Act. So the plaintiff had traveled outside of the U.S. to China, and then when he came back, he was denied entry, and the immigration officials told him that he was not a citizen. So then he sued. And ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled that he was a citizen because he was born in the U.S. regardless of his parents' immigration status. There's also a really interesting case that is actually not very old. It was from 2019, and it also deals with birthright citizenship. So this case is Devash Banks v. Pompeo, and they are a same-sex couple, and they had twins through surrogacy in Canada. The twins were conceived by anonymous donor eggs and sperm from both of the parents. So one of the parents is a U.S. citizen, but the other parent was born in Israel, and the Department of State basically gave citizenship to the child who was genetically linked to the U.S. citizen parent, but did not grant citizenship to the child who was linked to the Israeli-born parent. And this was because the law considered children born outside of the U.S. through surrogacy to be considered an out-of-wedlock child. So then, of course, the couple sued and said that, no, these children were born to married parents and they should be conferred U.S. citizenship status. Ultimately, the federal court did agree with the parents and stated that the child was born to parents who were married, and therefore the one child who was not given U.S. citizenship status was considered a citizen. So the new policy is now that if children are born through surrogacy and if at least one parent is a U.S. citizen and the parents are married, then the child could still acquire U.S. citizenship status. So I actually looked up how many countries give birthright citizenship versus countries that do not. So currently, 35 countries do have birthright citizenship, meaning that if you're born in that country, you are a citizen of that country. And there are 195 countries in the world. So that's about almost 18% of countries offer birthright citizenship. Whereas pretty much, I mean, the majority of countries do not offer birthright citizenship. What's interesting is that almost every country that does offer birthright citizenship is in the Americas, but most European countries do not offer it. Most Asian countries do not offer it. Australia doesn't offer it. Most countries in Africa don't offer it either. I saw an article that was written by James Ho, who is a U.S. Court of Appeals Fifth Circuit judge, and he was actually appointed by Trump. But he wrote an article in 2016 about the 14th Amendment, and basically he says that basically, there shouldn't be any questions about whether the 14th Amendment grants birthright citizenship or not, and that it does. And he said that people who oppose birthright citizenship argue that the language in the 14th Amendment that says all persons born or naturalized in the U.S., and this is the language here, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So the and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are what opponents to birthright citizenship are arguing, saying that, well, the people who came in without documents and who have children, they're not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. But he says that being subject to the jurisdiction just simply means that if you're in the U.S., you're subject to the authority of the U.S. government. You have to follow and obey all the U.S. laws. And if you don't, then you get in trouble. He does say that the clause is not there for no good reason. So there are going to be people who are excluded from obeying U.S. law. So, for example, foreign diplomats and enemy soldiers are not subject to U.S. law. So diplomats enjoy diplomatic immunity and lawful enemy combatants enjoy combatant immunity. So then children who are born to those people are not entitled to birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment because their parents are not subject to the laws and jurisdiction of the U.S. So if Trump becomes president again and tries to take away birthright citizenship by executive order, which he says he would do on day one, I'm sure many lawsuits will be filed challenging his authority to do this. That's all for this episode. Make sure to subscribe and share if you enjoyed it.